Hello, this is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Northland Views. We'll be reading from the White Mountain Independent and the Payson Roundup. And turning first to the White Mountain Independent, our first headline is Story About Nature, Tracking Arizona's Black Bears, a story by Tony Gibbons. From the high elevation forests of the White Mountains to the isolated Sky Island mountain ranges of southeastern Arizona, Arizona Game and Fish Department, also known as AZGFD, wildlife biologists are quietly following one of the state's most elusive animals. A new AZGFD video offers a behind-the-scenes look at the statewide black bear study, including the winter den checks that help researchers better understand Arizona's bear population and provide the scientific data needed to guide future wildlife management. One stop in the video takes viewers to the den of F7, a female black bear living in the mountains north of Flagstaff. Using her radio tracking collar to pinpoint F7's location, biologists carefully sedate the bear, remove her from the den long enough to examine her health, collect biological samples, and inspect the condition of her tracking collar before returning her to her winter shelter. The most important part of this den check is to ascertain collar fit and make sure it looks good, said Riley Jackson, terrestrial research program manager for AZGFD. She said they're projected to last about 3 years, but often they don't. Jackson said that every den check is carefully planned to protect both the researchers and the bears. She said, doing this den work is definitely a balance of what is safe for people and what is safe for the bear. Although many people think of bears as hibernating through the winter, Riley Jackson said that Arizona's black bears actually enter a state known as torpor, T-O-R-P-O-R, a lighter period of dormancy in which their metabolism slows but does not reach the deep metabolic state associated with true hibernation in bears. Once bear F7 is safely located outside her den, researchers continually monitor her vital signs while evaluating her body condition, estimating her age by examining her teeth, and determining whether her tracking collar needs to be replaced. Riley Jackson said, a lot of the work happens when it's outside the bear's den. She said, but honestly, getting her out and getting her back into the den is a huge part of the process. The den checks are just one part of a 5 to 6 year statewide study that began back in 2024. Researchers first captured and collared bears in 2025 and are working towards a goal of fitting 100 bears with GPS and VHF radio collars. So far, 59 bears have been collared across 4 of the study's 5 research areas. They include the forests surrounding Flagstaff, the White Mountains, the semi-desert mountain ranges of central Arizona, and the Sky Island mountain ranges of southeastern Arizona. The Prescott area is expected to become the 5th and final study area. The variety of study sites allows researchers to compare how bears behave across Arizona's dramatically different landscapes. Arizona is really unique in that we have such a variety of habitat types, said AZGFD wildlife specialist Sam Lysak, who heads the project. Sam said, a big part of this is seeing if the bears in the White Mountains are doing things differently from the bears in the Sky Islands. Using GPS and VHF radio collars, researchers are studying bear survival, causes of their death, seasonal movements, home range size, reproductive success, and den chronology, including when bears enter and leave their dens. The work continues throughout the year. Bears are trapped from late April through early October. Dens are scouted in December, and den checks are conducted from January through March. During the summer, researchers monitor female bears with cubs while also scouting future trapping locations. Tracking collars on the bears collect 4 to 5 location points each day, giving researchers a detailed picture of how bears move through Arizona's diverse landscapes. Jackson went on to say that one of the greatest challenges is learning enough about bear behavior to successfully capture a representative sample of animals. To minimize stress on the bears, researchers check traps at least twice a day before processing begins. Most of Arizona's previous black bear studies were conducted more than 20 years ago. According to the department, the updated research will be combined with harvest data to create more accurate population models that will help guide future management decisions, including hunting recommendations and responses to human-bear conflicts. American black bears are the only species of bear found in Arizona. Despite their name, their coats can range from black to brown, cinnamon, and even blonde. They inhabit forests and mountain ranges across northern, eastern, central, and southeastern Arizona. Turning from bears to more mundane but just as important news is a headline from Eager. Eager Town Council explores Chamber of Commerce move, certifies election results, and advances town business. A story by Jen Moreira. The Eager Town Council moved through a full agenda during its August 4th regular meeting, giving staff direction to explore a possible town hall move for the Springerville Eager Chamber of Commerce while certifying election results and advancing several other town items. The meeting was highlighted by a presentation from chamber representatives who outlined a broadened plan to stabilize and reorganize the Chamber of Commerce while addressing ongoing concerns with its current building in Springerville. The Springerville Eager Chamber of Commerce asked the town to consider allowing the organization to move into unused office space in the south end of Town Hall, formerly used by the Eager Police Department. Chamber President Tony Contreras and Vice President Amy Richard presented the proposal as part of a larger effort to reduce overhead, reorganize the chamber, and strengthen its long-term role in the community. Tony Contreras said the chamber's current Main Street building in Springerville needs substantial repairs and has become difficult for the organization to maintain. The chamber's written proposal also notes operating losses and identifies the possible move as one step towards improving its financial position. Contreras said, "I think it's important to the community to have a Chamber of Commerce in place." He noted that people looking for information about the area often turn first to the Chamber of Commerce. Contreras said, "What we're trying to do here is to find a way to keep the Chamber a viable part of the community." Town Manager Brandon Eager and staff and Chamber representatives toured the available space. He said the offices could accommodate the chamber and would primarily need flooring, paint, and minor touch-ups. The written proposal calls for an affordable lease or occupancy agreement and a gradual transition from the chamber's current property so services to businesses, residents, and visitors are not interrupted. It also includes a possible sale of the existing chamber building, payment of outstanding balances, rebranding work, and a leadership transition with Becky Christensen remaining involved while a new director is trained. Turning to election news, the town council unanimously approved the results of the July 21st primary election. The certified results show Bryce Burnham receiving 727 votes, Robert Ray received 612 votes, Reggie Peterson received 602, and Dale Thompson finished up receiving 541 votes. All four council seats were filled in the primary. Proposition 409, the town's permanent base adjustment, which allows the town of Eager to adjust its property tax base to account for growth and changes in assessed property values, passed with a vote of 602 in favor, against, and opposed to 338. The council also unanimously appointed Jeffrey Swango to a three-year term on the Planning and Zoning Commission, filling a vacancy on the seven-member board. The council also heard the first reading of Ordinance 2026-02. The ordinance would allow qualifying wildlife fences up to 8 feet tall without a conditional use permit being obtained. No vote was taken because the ordinance was presented for first reading. The proposed wildlife fences would have to use open, see-through materials such as woven or welded wire. They could not block visibility at intersections or driveways, sit in a public right-of-way or recorded easement, or create a risk of trapping or entangling wildlife. Existing setback requirements would continue to apply. Turning to news from Solo is a headline, Book Launch Party on August 14th for Children's Author. The White Mountains chapter of Arizona Professional Writers is hosting a book launch party for children's author Kimberly Waters at their monthly Share Your Words event from 5 to 7 in the evening on August 14th at the Arts Alliance of the White Mountains located at 251 Penrod Road. Kimberly Waters' latest book, Try a Little Harder to Find a Little Joy, is the first of the Try a Little Harder book series. Waters is best known for her Who Says series. Three of the dozen books are also available in Spanish. Kimberly Waters has a 36-year teaching career, many of those spent at Nicholas Homestead Elementary School in Solo. Her background in education influences her storytelling, blending creativity, encouragement, and meaningful life lessons into engaging adventures. White Mountains chapter of Arizona Professional Writers started Share Your Words to allow the public to hear from some of the talented writers, poets, and songwriters, both published and unpublished, who call the White Mountains home. A light meal and beverages will be provided. A $10 donation is requested to help cover the cost of food and the room. And from Springerville Eager is a headline, White Mountain Realtors Call for Pause on Lava Run and Black Ridge Projects, a story by Jen Morea. The White Mountain Association of Realtors, also known as WMAR, is calling for a pause on the proposed Lava Run and Black Ridge renewable energy projects after a poll commissioned by the organization found widespread opposition among likely voters in the region. WMAR announced the initial results on August 3rd. The association said 87% of respondents supported pausing further action on the two projects while an independent review of their potential effects is conducted. When asked directly about Lava Run and Black Ridge, 64% of respondents opposed the developments, 16% supported them, and 20% were undecided. Opposition increased to 76% after respondents heard arguments concerning the projects, according to a polling memo published by the association. The people who live and work in the White Mountains have made themselves clear. These projects are wrong for our region, WMAR President-elect Brian Anderson stated in the news release. The association represents more than 830 residential and commercial realtors in the White Mountains. It has created a public webpage containing its press release, polling memo, formal opposition statement, letters to members, and a statement from CEO Tricia Reed. Together, the documents outline why WMAR believes that Lava Run and Black Ridge, as presently proposed, pose unacceptable risks to property values, wildlife safety, water supplies, wildlife habitat, and the region's tourism-dependent character. WMAR said it is not opposed to renewable energy in principle. Its formal statement argues, however, that industrial-scale wind and solar facilities should not be placed where their economic, environmental, and public safety costs have not been fully considered. Property values are central to the association's position in this regard. WMAR says its review of appraisal research and market data found evidence of reduced residential property values near large wind facilities, particularly within approximately 2 miles of the turbines. The association argues that the potential effects could be greater in the White Mountains because the local real estate market depends heavily on mountain views, outdoor recreation, retirees, and second home buyers. Some WMAR members have already received questions from potential buyers who learned about proposed turbine locations while completing due diligence on property purchases, according to the association. WMAR also contends that additional transmission lines, substations, inverters, and battery storage systems would introduce new ignition risks in a region shaped by the Rodeo, Chudetsky, and Wallow forest fires. Its other concerns include construction-related water use, effects on wildlife corridors and dark skies, the conversion of working ranch land, and whether sufficient funding would be available to remove equipment and restore the sites decades from now. The association also questions how much of the project's promised economic benefit would remain in the region. WMAR acknowledges that construction would create jobs, but says those jobs would be temporary and that permanent operations would require relatively few employees. Tricia Reese said in a separate statement that the association believes that the projects have moved forward without enough community involvement. The White Mountain Association of Realtors is asking that elected officials to oppose the projects as currently cited or request their withdrawal until independent environmental, hydrologic, wildfire, and economic impact studies are completed. WMAR also wants stronger county and municipal authority over setbacks, turbine heights, lighting, sound limits, fire suppression requirements, and decommissioning bonds. Its formal statements call for decommissioning bonds to be independently verified, adjusted to reflect actual removal and reclamation costs, and reviewed every 5 years. WMAR also wants at least 60 days notice before public hearings, evening meeting times, and direct notifications of property owners near proposed turbines, solar arrays, substations, and transmission corridors. The association encourages members to contact county supervisors, municipal officials, and state legislatures, attend meetings, and raise questions about the project's potential effects. You're tuned in to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you're listening to the Wednesday edition of Northland Views. And now, turning to the news and sports, is a headline: St. John's, the hunted in fall girls soccer. Story by Keith Morris. The Redskins aren't wearing new uniforms this fall. But nobody sewed that big target on the backs of their jerseys, but that target is there. Opponents circle the date they get to test the defending state champion, and that's St. John's, which knocked off three-time defending state champion Flagstaff Northland Prep to win the fall championship a year ago. St. John's head coach Shayla Udall likes her team's chances of another strong season. Veterans should help bring the younger girls along as the Redskins continue to challenge the state's best. "We've just got strong leadership this year," said Udall, voted both North Region and Fall Coach of the Year. She said, "I think the girls are going to step up to the challenge." The Redskins went 5-0 to win the North title and capped off a 13-0 campaign with an epic shootout win over three-time defending champ Flagstaff Northland Prep in a game that was tied 2-2 after regulation and a pair of 10-minute overtime periods. St. John's won 4-3 on penalty kicks, knocking off the team that beat them in the semifinals the previous two seasons. The Redskins officially opened practice on July 27th. They opened the season in a flurry with a ranking game at Winslow on August 19th and four games between August 20th and the 21st in the Payson-Longhorn Invitational. They'll face Las Vegas, Nevada, El Dorado, and Snowflake the first day of the tournament and take on Payson and Winslow the final day. St. John's opens region play at Round Valley on August 25th before lifting the lid on the home schedule at St. John's Middle School against Camp Verde at 4 p.m. on August 27th. They play their final home game against Chino Valley on October 8th. The regular season ends with a game at Blue Ridge on October 22nd, and stay tuned. And now for a bit of history from the Navajo Nation with the headline, "The Legacy of Hubble Trading Post," a story by Tony Gibbons. More than a century after John Lorenzo Hubble purchased a small trading post in Ganada, Arizona, on the Navajo Indian Reservation, it remains a place where Navajo weavers, silversmiths, and artists combine a tradition that has connected generations of families. Visitors entering the trading post in Ganado today step through the same doorway generations before them have used. According to the National Park Service, the trading post itself remains entirely original, with ongoing maintenance and repairs, preserving both the exterior and interior while maintaining the historic structure. Looking down from above the entrance is a carved wooden figure of Ya Aste, a local Navajo man whose likeness was sculpted by artist Edward Warren Sawyer. For generations, that figure has welcomed visitors arriving at the trading post and going through the front entrance. John Lorenzo Hubble purchased the trading post back in 1878, just 10 years after the Diné were allowed to return to their homeland following their forced exile at Bosque Redondo at Fort Sumner, New Mexico. According to the National Park Service, Hubble became one of the most influential traders in the Southwest. Hubble encouraged excellence in Navajo weaving and silversmithing while building a business empire that eventually included stage and freight lines, a wholesale house in Winslow, and at various times, ownership of 24 trading posts. Although the trading post has changed ownership over the years, its purpose has remained remarkably consistent. The Hubble family operated the trading post until it was sold to the National Park Service back in 1967. Hubble Trading Post National Historic Site was formally established by an act of Congress on August 28, 1965, to preserve the historic trading post, its buildings, collections, and surrounding landscape for future generations. Today, the trading post remains an active business operated through a partnership between the National Park Service and Western National Parks, the nonprofit education partner that continues the trading traditions established by the Hubble family nearly 150 years ago. Visitors can now still purchase authentic Navajo rugs, jewelry, pottery, and other artwork directly from native artists and experience a trading tradition that has remained a vital part of the community for generations. Rather than serving only as a museum, the Hubble Trading Post continues to function much as it always has, as a place where commerce, culture, and storytelling come together, connecting today's visitors with the traditions of the Diné people. Well, that wraps up the news from the White Mountain Independent. We travel west along the rim and look at news from the Payson Roundup. With the headline, Payson lands a $2.7 million grant for trailheads, a story by Peter Allshire. Payson has received word that it will get $2.7 million in state grants to complete two new trailheads connected to the Granite Dells Trail system, town manager Darren Caldwell announced Tuesday at an appearance before the Payson Tea Party. The town will provide a $166,000 match for a project it hopes will turn the long-neglected Granite Dells Trails network into a major amenity for residents and an important draw for the tourists who support the town's economy. The grant stemmed from the joint efforts of Anna Van Zyl of the Rim Country Trails Fund and Steve Richardson, head of the Payson Parks and Recreation Department, said Caldwell. The Rim Country Mountain Bike Association and the Payson Ranger District of the Tonto National Forest have also supported upgrading the trailhead. The grant comes in the wake of Payson Ranger District Recreational Director Angie Abel's years-long effort to do the studies to bring most of the Payson area trail system trails through the forest into the official Forest Service system. The groups won money previously to design the trailheads with parking, signage, group facilities, and community gathering points, which made it possible to get the money for actual construction. The two trailheads provide access and parking for a whole network of trails, including Boulders, Cypress, Yorba Loop, Bunny Hop, Around the Bend, Over the Top, Billy Goat, and Bootleg. We nearly doubled the grant money we received last year to $8 million, said Caldwell. Let's hope they all come to fruition, he adds, and we get them all done. And in late breaking news is the headline. Plane crashes northwest of Payson. Two people reported aboard. A story by Alexis Beckman. A plane crashed in the Mazatlal Wilderness west of Payson Monday evening, prompting a multi-agency response to reach the remote crash site. Gila County Sheriff J. Adam Shepard said the plane crash was located west of Poles Mesa in the Mazatal Wilderness. According to a release from the Gila County Sheriff's Office, the Arizona Department of Emergency and Military Affairs contacted the Sheriff's Office at approximately 6 p.m. on August 10th, Monday, regarding a possible downed aircraft. The Maricopa County Sheriff's Office responded with Fox 1, its helicopter, to assist in locating the crash site. Because of the remote location and rugged terrain, a Pinal County Sheriff's Office helicopter was assisting Tuesday morning with transporting deputies to the site for the initial investigation. At least two occupants have been reported to be aboard the plane that crashed. The National Transportation Safety Board and the Federal Aviation Administration have been called in to conduct the investigation. Well, that wraps up the news from the White Mountains and Payson in this edition of Northland Views. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'll be back with you next week for the next edition of Northland Views on Wednesday. Thank you so much for listening.